Welcome to these Bible lessons on the Old Testament. In these lessons, we'll cover God's magnificent creation of all the world, including the creation of man, the crown of God's creation. We'll follow with the sad fall of man in paradise and the consequences this brought to the world. In the continuing lessons, we'll teach how God visits men with the revelation of His covenant of grace. When we travel together through the entire Old Testament, we see God visiting His nation of Israel with revelations of this covenant of grace, pointing constantly to the coming Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. We hope these lessons are a blessing to you. Thank you.
After the death of Ahab, his son Ahaziah became the next king of Israel. As we cover the history of these kings, we might find ourselves wondering how and why the Lord tolerated their wickedness. But we need to remember that God's ways are not our ways, nor His thoughts our thoughts. God did punish wicked kings, and both Israel and Judah as nations would eventually be punished as well and carried into captivity by their enemies. God is also merciful, patient, and long-suffering. And so He would also send prophets to warn and to instruct the people. In this lesson, we will consider the work of the prophet Elisha. Ahaziah only reigned for 2 years. The closing verses of 1 Kings chapter 22 summarize his reign. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the way of his father, and in the way of his mother, and in the way of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, for he served Baal and worshipped him, and provoked to anger the Lord God of Israel, according to all that his father had done. After Ahab's death, the Moabites, who had been subjugated by David, took advantage of the transition of the kingdom from Ahab to Ahaziah and rebelled against Israel. It appears that the Lord used this as a punishment or judgment for Ahaziah's sin. Ahaziah wants to crush this rebellion, but he has a problem. He has fallen through a lattice in an upstairs room in his house and received some serious injuries to the extent that he has become seriously ill. This is a serious calling. Surely he will call to the Lord for deliverance. Unfortunately, that is not how he was brought up as a child. He was never taught about the Lord of Israel. Both his parents were Baal worshippers. It seems that in a few generations, true religion and worship had all but disappeared in the lives of the royal family. What a lesson for us to remember to instruct our children in the way of the Lord, so that when they are older, they will not depart from it. So what does Ahaziah do? He sends messengers to Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, to find out whether or not he will recover. What foolishness! Ahaziah is about to get a wake-up call. God sends an angel to Elijah with a message for Ahaziah. Are you doing this because there is no longer a God in Israel? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not come down from that bed on which thou art gone up, but shalt surely die. This is what Elijah tells the messengers that Ahaziah sent. It appears that these messengers were not far into their journey when Elijah met them, because Ahaziah asks why they have come back. They give him the message, and Ahaziah asks what this man looked like. He knows immediately who it was, Elijah the Tishbite. His father, no doubt, told him all about Elijah and the supposed trouble he always made for him. So does this prophet think he can get away with this also? We will see about that, he thinks. He sends a captain with 50 soldiers to get Elijah. Elijah is easy to find. He's sitting on the top of a hill in clear view. The captain calls out to him, "Man of God, come down." Commentators are divided on whether this was mockery or if the captain was using this title respectfully. I think from Elijah's response, it was the former. He says, "If I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And that is exactly what happens. The men are struck dead. The news gets back to Ahaziah, and he is not happy. This makes no impression on him whatsoever, except to make him angrier and impatient. He sends another captain, and this time he adds quickly to the command. The result is the same. God kills them with fire from heaven. Another captain is sent, but this captain respectfully asks that his and his soldiers' lives be spared. And they are. The angel tells Elijah to go to the king. His message has not changed. Ahaziah will not recover, and he will die because of essentially trusting in Baal rather than God. And so he does. Having no sons, his brother Jehoram becomes king of Israel, not to be confused with Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, who reigned approximately the same time. There is a direct shift in focus at this point in 2 Kings chapter 2 to provide the background for Elijah's departure from earth and the beginning of Elisha's role as lead prophet. Elijah and Elisha are traveling together when Elijah asks Elisha to wait for him as he travels to Bethel. Elisha refuses and says, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they make the trip together, and upon their arrival, other prophets meet them and ask Elisha if he knows that Elijah will be taken from him that day. Elisha acknowledges that and tells them to hold their peace. Elijah then asks Elisha to wait at Bethel while he travels to Jericho. And again, Elisha refuses with the same response. At Jericho, prophets meet them and ask Elisha the same question as the previous group, and his response is the same again. Now Elijah asks Elisha to wait at Jericho while he goes to the Jordan. But again, Elisha refuses. Again, they travel onward together. And when they get to the river, something miraculous happens. As the other prophets are watching from a distance, Elijah rolls up his mantle and hits the water with it. Immediately, the water parts, and there is a dry path for them to cross the riverbed to the other side. Once they are safely on the other side, Elijah asks if there is anything that Elisha wants before he departs. He asks for a double portion of his spirit, and Elijah, realizing that this is not a blessing for him to give, tells him if he is allowed to see him depart, that request will be granted, but otherwise not. Suddenly, a chariot of fire appears with horses of fire, and Elijah is carried up to heaven by a whirlwind. Elisha cries out, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof," expressing what Elijah was for the nation of Israel. Elijah is gone, and Elisha is alone. Walking back to the bank of the Jordan River, he uses Elijah's mantle to hit the water. "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" The water parts, and Elisha returns. The other prophets recognize that Elisha has the same spirit that Elijah had. and they bow before him to show him reverence. But some are wondering what actually happened to Elijah. They think that perhaps his body is somewhere, so they ask if they can look for it. Elisha says no, but they continue to press the issue until Elisha relents. They spend 3 days looking, but obviously are not successful. Elisha basically says, "I told you so." It is clear at this point that Elisha has taken over the role of Elijah. The city inhabitants come out to see Elisha and mention that, as he can see, the city is nice, but the water is bad and the land is barren. Is it possible that he might be able to do something about this? He asks for a new jar and some salt and pours the salt into the water. Elisha says, "Thus saith the Lord, I have healed these waters. There shall not be from hence any more death or barren land." The miracle occurs by the power of God, and the people can see that Elisha is truly a man of God, a true prophet of the Lord. But not everyone recognizes this. As he is making his way back to Bethel, a group of boys, probably teenagers, come out to mock the prophet and say, "Go up, bald one." There are some who think this was a reference to Elijah's ascension, but it is highly unlikely that they would know anything about that. They probably had no idea who he was, but recognized his clothing that was worn by prophets. Such a man would be thought fit sport for the children of Baal worshippers of Bethel. They were most probably set on and encouraged in their mockery by their parents. We read, "And he turned back and looked on them and cursed them in the name of the Lord. And there came forth 2 she-bears out of the wood and tare 42 children of them." Elisha did not do this because he was personally offended, but because the Lord's honor was at stake. God sent these bears to punish these boys for their sin. And so he returns to Samaria. Do you remember at the beginning of the lesson when I mentioned that the Moabites were challenging Israel? Now Jehoram is king and nothing has changed, so he asks Jehoshaphat if he would fight with him against the Moabites. He agrees, and so does the king of Edom. A week later, they find themselves without water, neither for the men nor for their animals. Jehoram attributes it to the Lord delivering the 3 of them into the hands of the Moabites. But Jehoshaphat is not so quickly discouraged. He does the right thing, although he should have done it before they began. He asks if there is a prophet of the Lord to consult. Jehoram evidently does not know, but a servant says that Elisha is with them. Jehoshaphat knows right away that this is a true prophet of God whose word can be trusted. The kings go to meet him, but Elijah wants nothing to do with Jehoram. He tells him to go and seek the false prophets of his parents, but Jehoshaphat intervenes and says they will need his help and advice. Elisha responds and says that if it were not for Jehoshaphat, he would not even look at Jehoram. Elisha asks for a minstrel to play, and as he is playing, God reveals what should be done. They must dig a great number of ditches, and God would fill them with water even though there would be no rain. And not only that, Elisha continues, this is really nothing in God's hands, but he will do even more. He will defeat the Moabites. The next morning, the ditches are full of water and all can drink. The Moabites have heard that these 3 kings with their armies have come for battle, so they prepare as well. When they are looking over the valley early in the morning, all the water looks like blood to them, either from the angle of the sun or from the reddish earth in which the ditches were dug. The Moabites assume somehow a great slaughter has taken place, and all the kings are dead. They rush to spoil the dead armies, only to be attacked by the Israelites. The Moabites suffer great losses. Their cities are destroyed, the wells are plugged with stones, and many trees are cut down. Did Jehoram deserve to have the Lord defeat the enemy in this way? Absolutely not. This was yet another testimony of God's undeserving mercy and grace. 2 Kings chapter 4 again focuses on Elisha. The next account we have is about a widow whose late husband was a God-fearing prophet that Elisha evidently knew. Her dilemma is that she owes a lot of money, and the creditor is going to take her two sons if she doesn't pay. "What do you have?" asks Elisha. The only thing she has is a small container of oil. Elisha tells her to borrow every empty pot she can from her neighbors. Once she does that, she is to close the door of her house and pour the oil from the small container and fill all these empty pots. Then she can sell the extra oil and pay her debt. Miraculously, the small container does not run out, and all the other containers are filled with oil, which she then can sell. This is one of the many miracles that the Lord performed through his prophet, Elisha. The next account we have is about a wealthy woman who provides Elisha with a meal every time he passes through her village. We are not told how the initial visit came about, but she deduces after a few visits that Elisha is a prophet of God, and she and her husband decide to add a small room onto their house for him to use when he passes through. Today we would say that this would be his own little apartment where he could study or sleep if he wanted. Touched by her kindness and generosity, Elisha instructs his servant Gehazi to ask the woman if she needs or wants anything. Gehazi says she really does not need anything, but just for the record, she has no children. Elisha tells her that in about a year, she shall have a son. The woman cannot believe this and thinks Elisha is making this up, but it happens as he says. She finally has a child. Some time passes, probably 5 to 8 years, and the child is in the field with his father and others watching them harvest. He complains of a headache and is taken home to his mother. He sits on her lap until noon, and then he dies. His mother puts his dead body on Elisha's bed and tells her husband she needs a donkey to visit Elisha. Her husband is confused. It is not a Sabbath day or a new moon. Why would she need to go to Elisha? "It is well," she says, and goes on her way. Her husband knows nothing about the child. When the woman arrives, she grabs Elisha by the feet and says, "Did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'?" Elisha realizes something is terribly wrong and instructs Gehazi to hurry to her house and not to stop for anything until he gets there, and then lay his staff on the child. Elisha and the woman follow. When they arrive at the home, Gehazi says the child has not awakened. And when Elisha goes in, he sees that the child is dead. This seems like a lost case, but with God, all things are possible. We read, "He went in therefore and shut the door upon them and prayed unto the Lord. And he went up and lay upon the child and put his mouth upon his mouth and his eyes upon his eyes and his hands upon his hands, and he stretched himself upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. Then he returned and walked in the house to and fro and went up and stretched himself upon him. And the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, 'Call this Shunammite.' So he called her, and when she came in unto him, he said, 'Take up thy son.' Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground and took up her son and went out. With reverence and gratitude, she acknowledges Elisha and God for this great miracle. Another instance of a miracle performed by Elisha takes place in Gilgal. There was a famine in the land, and the prophets are gathering food for a meal. One finds a number of wild gourds or melons, but really does not know what kind they are, so he shreds them into the pot to cook. When it comes time to eat, as soon as they taste it, they think that it is poisonous. Elisha asks for some meal, throws it in the pot, and the food becomes harmless, and it is fit to eat. During the same time, someone brings an offering to Elisha of first fruits, some loaves, and some grain. Elisha tells him to use it to feed the sons of the prophets, but he objects, saying that it's not nearly enough. Elisha tells him to do it anyway, and not only will there be enough, that there will also be leftovers. Just like the miracle Christ performed with the loaves and fishes, there is enough to eat with food left over. The last account we will consider in this lesson has to do with a very important Syrian named Naaman. He has contracted leprosy. In God's providence, his wife's maid happens to be a young captive Israelite girl. It was a common practice for heathen nations to invade neighboring countries to plunder and to take what they could and quickly leave. This was not necessarily an act of all-out war. As any young child would do, this maid, when hearing that Naaman is leprous, suggests that if he were in her country, he might be healed because in her country, there is a great prophet living there. So this gets back to Naaman and the king of Syria, who says, "Go, I will send a letter to the king of Israel, telling him you are on your way." We read, "And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment." This is great news. But Jehoram, king of Israel, does not think so. He thinks this is a ruse to create trouble or even war. Elisha hears that Jehoram has ripped his clothes to show his distress. Elisha goes to the king and tells him, "Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." Naaman goes to Elisha's house, probably expecting this great prophet to come out and show him due respect and perform some amazing miracle in the sight of everyone. But instead, Elisha sends a messenger out to meet Naaman with a strange message: "Go wash in the Jordan River 7 times." "What? Is this some kind of joke? I came all the way from Syria to be told to go wash myself in your muddy river? Don't we have better rivers in Syria like Abana and Pharpar?" Completely disgusted, Naaman leaves in a fury. Absolutely ridiculous. One of his servants has been thinking everything over. "Wait a moment," he says. "If this prophet had asked you to do some incredible task, wouldn't you have done it? So why don't you just try what he said? It can't hurt to try." Naaman gives in and goes to the river. He dips in 7 times, and miraculously, his leprosy is gone. His skin becomes like a child's skin, soft and clean. Naaman is humbled because of the healing. We read, "He returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him, and he said, 'Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant.'" When there is deliverance, there should also be true gratitude. Naaman is truly grateful for this cure, and he wishes to express his gratitude through a gift. But Elisha knows that the curing was God's work, not his. So he refuses to take anything. God alone should receive the honor. Naaman asks permission to take some soil back with him to Samaria, enough to build an altar or to cover an area of ground to sanctify it. It seems as if he has renounced idolatry and only wants to worship the true God of Israel from this time forward. But he foresees a problem. He will have to accompany the king when he worships, so he asks for forgiveness in advance. Elisha tells him to depart in peace. Elisha's servant Gehazi has witnessed everything and secretly thinks Elisha should have taken at least some of the gifts. So he follows after Naaman, and when he catches up to him, he concocts a story about how a gift was desired after all, to give to some visiting sons of other prophets. The gifts weigh so much that some of Naaman's servants help Gehazi carry it back to the house, but not all the way. Gehazi brings the gift the rest of the way so he can hide it in the house so that Elisha doesn't see it. Elisha asks him where he has been. He says, nowhere. But Elisha tells him he not only knows where he went, but he also knows about the gift. As a result of his sin, he will now have Naaman's leprosy, which will remain with him the rest of his life and will be passed on to his family. Gehazi's punishment is immediate and permanent. We have seen a lot in this lesson. We have seen the wages of sin in many different persons. Sin will be punished, either in the individual or through the finished work of Christ. We have also seen the continued undeserved mercy of God, both to individuals and the nation of Israel. God remains faithful as he provides prophets like Elijah and Elisha to minister unto the people. Let us seek this merciful God while he is yet to be found.